7:42 now. Good morning. Again, we've got 30 degrees here in Old Town Park City, looking for mostly sunny skies and a high of 56. Well, as we've been reporting, a rock-throwing incident last week apparently targeting the superintendent of Park City Schools and the district-owned home that she and her family live in Jeremy Ranch has dismayed members of the Board of Education. On the phone to comment, I have the school board president and spokesman, Andrew Kaplan. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
So can you give us an idea of the school board's reaction to this incident?
Well, we're disappointed. I think we're disappointed, we're embarrassed, and upset. You know, I think it's a shame. I think it shows the community how quickly issues that are voiced on social media can get out of hand. And I think it's an opportunity for all of us to do some self-reflection and look at ourselves as a community and say, okay, who do we want to be, right? Do we want to be kind to our neighbors? Do we want to be angry and harassing every time there's something that we don't agree with on social media? How do we want to behave? And it's unfortunate. I think this is something that's going on all over the country with various issues. So it's not super surprising, but, we'd like to see the community, take this experience and move on from it in a positive way.
Your director of communications, Melinda Colton, and I had a couple of email exchanges yesterday that, in fact, a window was broken. She wouldn't confirm if it was a rock that broke it. She, at the time yesterday, said the district didn't know if it was an intentional act. So I'm guessing what happened in the last 16 hours that the district now thinks that the broken window was specifically targeted to threaten or intimidate the superintendent and her family?
I don't know. I think that, it was definitely vandalism. How it was done, whether it was kicked in or broken or a rock was thrown through, I'm not really sure. But, what we do know is the house was vandalized and a window is broken. And it coincided with a lot of comments on the Nextdoor app or platform about work that was being done on the superintendent's house and specifically outside with regards to repaving a driveway and doing some hillside mitigation, retaining walls and things like that. And those are all projects that we knew as a district we had to do when we purchased the home. We wanted to purchase a home to satisfy the community's desire for the superintendent to live within the school district boundaries. And we made a decision that it made more economic sense to own a home rather than pay a stipend and rent. So at least we would be on the residential property ladder in the city and, we would be able to have a superintendent living within the school district boundaries in perpetuity, regardless of what happened with property values in the community. So that was something we knew. That was something, the work that's being done or that was just completed was in the budget. We have a very lengthy budget process that starts actually right around now. It will probably start next month and then goes into the spring. It's a very public process where there's a number of different iterations of budget line items. And then there's a public approval process. And then there's also an additional truth and taxation hearing. Depending on what the outcomes of those budget decisions are on taxes in August. So it's a pretty lengthy public process. We always ask that the public gives us their input in all aspects of the budget, and this is no different. But we spend millions of dollars a year on improving our capital projects. So all of our facilities, it's a separate budget from our M&O, which is the operating budget, which does things like pay teachers. So it's a separate bucket. There's separate taxes that are associated with capital expenditures. We always welcome public input and comments.
Sure. So are there surveillance cameras at the home? And if not, do we need to perhaps install them to protect the safety of the Gillet family?
Yeah, there haven't been. It wasn't something that we considered. You know, we assumed that there wouldn't be issues like that, especially not with the superintendent and her family living there. But I think that's something we will look at as a whole security review going forward.
Yeah. So was a rock found inside the home or not? Because I'm still not clear if it was a rock.
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I know that the window was broken. I'm not sure how.
All right. The Sheriff Department spokesman Andrew Wright first told me that there was no police report. The director of Park City School District Communications told me that the superintendent hadn't filed one. She was busy getting the window repaired. Do we need to file one now so an investigation can be made, or is it just too late at this point?
No, I think there will be one filed. Superintendent, it happened at the end of last week. The superintendent went to a conference over the weekend and has been out of town, and I think had been in touch with the sheriff's office, but hadn't filed an official police report. But I suspect one will be filed today.
Yeah.
Now that she's back in town.
Yeah. There were TV crews from Salt Lake City stationed outside of the home and waiting, really, standard procedure to do cut-ins for their live news shots. And I guess, was there anything happening at the home while the media was there that made the Gildays feel unsafe?
Yeah, I think it's, I think having people park in your driveway and refusing to move or parked outside the house. I don't think they were in the driveway, but I think parked outside the house was not a great experience. It's obviously their right to report news and to park on the street and camp outside someone's home, but I think that is probably a pretty uncomfortable situation for folks. And I think it's, you know, if it was random that the news truck showed up, I think that'd be one thing. I think given that neighbors were specifically complaining about the work that was being done and, you know, people have been going by the house and making comments to the superintendent and her family, negative comments about the work being done, it's, you know, it's troublesome, right? And you know, again, I think the most upsetting thing, and I can't speak for Dr. Gilday, but I think the upsetting thing for the district is, you know, no one came to school board members, no one came to the superintendent and said, hold on a second, what is it that you're doing? How much does this cost? What's going on here? They just decided to start complaining and on social media and making, making statements, assuming certain things. And that's where we got in trouble. Right, as a community, I think is oftentimes social media is so easy to access. It's right on our phones, and you know we're on it all day long. And so we think, okay, easiest thing for me to do when I'm upset about something or I have a question about something is to use social media or the internet to find the answer, as opposed to using old-fashioned human communication. And I think that's really where this situation got out of control.
Yeah, I know there's been a lot of criticism about the driveway that's been installed, a heated driveway. And I just want to make, I was pulled aside by a snowplow driver who informed me that heated driveways are much more sustainable in the long run than having a diesel truck haul up the hill and plow your driveway. So I don't know if that makes any difference, but I mean, I didn't know that until somebody actually told me that. So your director of communications had made a statement saying that there was misinformation in the television report. Do you want to address any of those inaccuracies? Or?
Yeah, I think I'm going to leave some of that. I think we're going to reserve the right to speak to the television station about the things they said, but that specific reporter has made inaccurate statements about us before. And, you know, I think the cost of the project was misleading, as well as there were allegations, I believe, of corruption and misuse of public funds that were made, which potentially are slanderous. So We're going to continue to look at that. And it's upsetting for us that a major news station would make allegations, or I should say a reporter from a major news station would make allegations of corruption when having no facts or no knowledge of the situation. And it's, you know, it couldn't be further from the truth. It's something that we knew about when we purchased the house that we were going to do improvements. It's something that's been in budget documents for quite some time. It's something that was in an approved budget. I think those types of statements can be very dangerous because, you know, when people see that on the news or they see it on the reporter's Facebook post, they take it for fact, right? And people have a right to be upset if they think that something inappropriate has gone on. But in this case, it was, somewhat irresponsible of that gentleman to make those accusations.
So where do we go from here?
Well, I think we use this as an opportunity for the community to grow and to recognize that, when you disagree with something or you have an opinion, the best way to deal with it is to, you know, talk to the people who you disagree with, find out the facts, understand what's going on, be kind to your neighbors. We all have disagreements with our neighbors, with people we know, people we don't know. That's part and parcel of living in a community. But I think we need to remind ourselves that we're very fortunate to all live here. This is a wonderful place. Our lives are, for the most part, very fortunate, and we want to, continue enjoying and living in this community. And in order to do that, we have to treat each other with respect and courtesy and not assume bad intent. You know, a lot of it is for all of us just to assume good intent when we see our neighbors on the street or, we're stuck in traffic trying to get to the ski resort or whatever it is. We have to take a step back and recognize that life is good and we should appreciate each other.
Appreciate you taking time out of your busy morning, Andrew, to talk to us.
Thanks for the call, Leslie. Appreciate it.
7:55 now, you're listening. Well, it was a close election, only 123 votes separating those for and against the $87 million school bond for South Summit School District. But it appears that bond has been defeated. On the phone to tell us more, I have the superintendent of schools there, Shad Sorensen. Good morning, Shad. But I guess
good morning,
it's not
Leslie.
So.
How are you today?
I'm doing good. I guess it's not so good for you. Any idea how many votes are still outstanding here?
We have not heard, but statistically we have found, and as we've talked to people and even with the bond 2 years ago, the margins stay about the same. Of course, there's always hope, and that would be wonderful if that was the case, but we are anticipating that it'll probably be similar margins.
Yeah, so what's the reaction then of the school board?
You know, one of the things that our public education system values, local control and democracy. And our residents have the opportunity to express their feelings towards the long-term solution to manage growth and educate students. I feel that the Board of Education did due diligence in looking at all possible solutions and proposing what they felt was the best solution, and then having the opportunity to inform and educate, and I think we did a much better job this time. My goal was that people did not have to vote without information. And I've heard a lot of feedback from people that they appreciated all of the information that was provided from the district so that they can make an informed decision. So to me, that is a celebration. And when I talk about the bittersweet, that is one of the sweets because I think we did a great job in helping our community know the facts and know the information.
Yeah. Any guesses why it was defeated? Just too expensive?
I think there's a fraction of people that felt that it was too expensive and just felt overly taxed in all situations with different taxes that have come into play. I think there's another fraction that didn't like the fact of where the facility was going to be located and felt that putting that facility there would be the first step in many homes and other things out there and taking away that what they want to serve as pristine open space. And then I think there's a small fraction that just didn't see the need for a high school, felt a different plan, maybe working on that other end with elementaries and then moving grades amongst schools if a new elementary school was built. So I think it's a combination of those three being the biggest issue.
Yeah, so do you go ahead and try follow up? Or, I guess you can't really find out who voted against it, but, how do you move forward from here?
You know, the board has had conversations in regards to what is our backup plan. And, of course, the most probable short-term solution would be portables in the near future. Based on growth next year in our elementary school, we're probably going to need 1 to 2 classrooms. The high school is already at a point where they need 1 to 2 classrooms. So very likely we'll be looking at a couple portables. The board is not against looking at a bond in the future, and whether that be a bond for another elementary school or whether that be bonding to build on to our current schools or to try again for a high school, that will be left up to the board, and that will be a decision made after the community polling and community input meetings.
Yeah, so any idea what the cost of a portable classroom costs these days?
You know, I better not say, but I would believe that it'll probably be well over $100,000, but I'm shooting out there because I haven't done a lot of research, and without our business administrator here who's handling that side of it, I dare not say exactly.
So whatever the cost,
time of the portable, but then there's even more expense with getting infrastructure out there, and then the security of portables, making sure that the intercom system works and the locking system works and that they are accessible for students with wheelchairs or other types of services that are needed. And those costs become extremely expensive in addition to just purchasing the portable.
Yeah, so whatever the cost, we're going to multiply it by 2 to 4 times that, right?
Very likely, yeah.
Yeah.
I just got a text, and one of the things that I had heard is a lot of Francis people have saying that they hadn't received their ballot, and so they did go in and vote through the mail-in ballot. So it will be interesting to see how many are out there, actually, based on this text that I just received.
Yeah. So what do you do with the property that you purchased there? Do you just hold on to it?
The board will make that decision, but I would guess, because it was such an amazing deal. And whether the school goes in first and then houses come around it, or whether houses come in first and then a school is built, it's inevitable. The projections are out there. The planning commissions have approved building lots, et cetera, and it's inevitable that growth will happen. And so there will come a time when school facilities are needed on that property. And so I think because of the amazing financial deal that the district received with that land, I think they will probably hang on to it. But again, everything's always open to negotiation and consideration.
Yeah. So are you going to be okay then for next school year since you've already adopted a budget?
Yes. Yeah. We've got our budget for this year, and then we will adopt a budget for next year. And most likely, if we're looking at adopting next year's budget, we'll be looking at potential portables.
Right. So
to
that
manage the near-term growth.
So we could see truth in taxation as a result.
Very probable, or potentially a smaller bond for those types of things.
Okay. All right, Chad, anything else you wanted to say to our listeners?
You know, I just want to express my appreciation to everyone for finding the facts and making an informed decision. I think as a community, it's been a little bit of a divisive issue. Our children do not need to be divided. Now is the time to come together and be solution-focused and minded, and work together to come up with the best solution for our children. We want our children prepared, we want them valued, and we want them to be able to excel and accomplish their goals and dreams, and education is the foundation for that. So we need to work together as a community to make that happen and move forward unitedly.
Okay. Hey, Chad, I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Park City Council meeting Thursday to discuss, among other things, traffic and transportation in Old Town, historic preservation, and more. In the studio with a preview, I have Interim City Manager Matt Dias and Economic Development Director Jonathan Weidenhammer. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Hey, Matt, let's just start with you. When is your official probation period over?
Well, hopefully that will be determined by City Council, and I'm not aware of that yet. I presume it had something to do with the election, not to deprive a future decision of new council members in the event that they took a seat. And obviously we're very thankful for all the poll workers that put in all the effort yesterday and everyone who worked on that election and the county and our staff. But that's a determination that City Council will make.
Okay, after the new year.
I don't know if it'll be after the new year, but now that we have an incoming group, I think that they just, you know, if there was a big turn or a big change, I presume they didn't want to deprive that new group of that decision or to have some input. But again, I'm speculating probably in an area that I shouldn't. I'm clearly excited about the opportunity and very enthusiastic about it.
Yeah. So do you have, as interim city manager, do you have a contract?
I don't. Nope. I'm still under sort of a probationary period, the same stipulations I was under before.
Okay. So once that, or if that does, then the contract would be signed at that point.
Exactly. Just like any other sort of manager at the county or at the city level.
Okay. Let's see. Jonathan, Park City has launched its Old Town Access and Circulation Plan to improve transportation and traffic around Main Street and the surrounding neighborhoods. It's about solutions that are short-term in nature, not capital improvements. The first step after some smaller items this summer, we made 4th and 5th Street one way. Now is to assess the situation and kind of create a plan, and it looks like that could cost up to some $280,000. So what does that get us?
Well, it gets us a baseline, a lot of data. You know, we've been speculating, and we've been talking emotionally about how big or bad it is or what it is or where it is. Is this group or that group or this cab or that safety issue? And I think we want to kind of put a bullet in, establish a baseline of what it is, how many cars, what kind of cars are they, what time do they come, when is it really busy, when is it dangerous, what are the response times. So, to collect robust data and establish that baseline, it'll take a significant amount of effort. And I think there's been some sticker shock to that number, to that timing. And I think some of staff and a lot of council and I think a lot of the community have a higher expectation that we can really maybe get some things done sooner, quicker, faster, better while we wait to establish that baseline.
Yeah. So do we what? Just put those road strips down? Is that how it works?
There's a number of different ways to count. Some of the counts that we have data on are done by video camera where you actually monitor it and you count the cars and where they turn. Other things are those little data strips. We actually have a video camera up on Hillside right now that takes counts itself year-round. But what it doesn't do is distinguish type of vehicle. It doesn't tell me if it's a cab driver. It doesn't tell me if it's an Uber. It doesn't tell me if it's a hotel shuttle or a semi-truck. And so there's different things we need to collect to answer all the questions we have.
So what is it that we're going to do in the meantime?
Well, in the meantime, you know, last time we talked to City Council, I think it was August 15th, commensurate with the broader circulation and access study, they talked about creating some drop and load zones on Main Street. And so we've been spending a lot of time trying to refine that conversation. That coupled with some voluntary efforts from the Lodging Association to reduce trips on some of the streets. We've refined that program and we're recommending most substantially a couple of more, but probably most importantly, prohibiting other commercial drop and load and pickup on Main Street without one of these drop and load parking permits. So that's kind of a big change from what we were talking about 2 months ago, but we think that's the key to making this whole thing actually function and work.
So who gets one of those permits?
Whoever wants to buy one. You can buy one. I can buy one. A local cabbie can buy one, an Uber driver, whoever. So we would expect a lot of the existing local for-hire group to buy them, and we've been working closely with Lodging, and we think they're excited about the opportunity to have premium access to the street.
Are they transferable?
They could, I think they could be transferable between a fleet, but if you're going to come and drop and load on the street, you have to have a permit.
Okay, and so we're going to have people out there making sure that you've got a
well,
permit.
We've heard loud and clear, probably from council and certainly from the local groups we've been talking to, that enforcement is going to be the key. We can't have people without them using them.
Okay, so how many areas are we talking about?
I appreciate you asking, because when we started this, it was 3 on Main Street and 2 in Sweet Alley, and we've heard loud and clear that the level of service that people who are, you know, staying in the Montage or spending a lot of money in town, not having more of them throughout the street, isn't going to give the level of service that we want. And so again, we got some preliminary support from the Main Street business folks on the 3 on Main Street and 2 off. But we're recommending tonight expansion to a minimum of 5 of those on the street, if not up to 8. And then commensurate with that, there's still going to be other people that need to drop off that don't have a permit. So we want to have a talk with Council Thursday about creating a drop and load zone in Sweet Alley that's free.
Okay. And in terms of, I mean, how many spaces are we taking up along the street? Or I guess, I mean,
you know, these
taking
zones,
it away from paid parking.
These
at that
zones
point,
would
right?
probably be about 2 or 3 spots each. So, you know, you can get up to the 10-20 area pretty quickly. And so Main Street, we're going to have to hear what they have to say on Thursday night. Because they, you know, they're originally very excited about these would be 15-minute parking throughout the day, no permit necessary. And that's been something I think we've needed on the street for a while. And they were mixed in their opinion on whether we should have, you know, forego the paid parking or have more drop and load zones on Main Street. There wasn't a consensus from that group. And it affects, you know, a retailer differently than a restaurant, differently than another type of business. So it's hard to get a consensus out of the group.
Yeah, so my understanding is that kind of the Lyft and Uber type companies don't have to drop and pick up. I mean, we can't enforce them?
Well, with the idea that we would preclude it on the entire street, they're not going to be able to double park on the street. And without having a parking permit to be in one of these new zones, they would have to find another alternative. And hence the recommendations to create a drop and load zone or numerous ones on Sweet Alley.
All right. And back to an earlier discussion with council in terms of maybe removing the gates in China Bridge. Is that contemplated to happen this winter? This winter?
We're evaluating that. I think we've got a new team in our transit and transportation department, and they're evaluating that. And I think 9 out of 10 of the reasons is for customer service and efficiency of the system. We've had at times when the system gets overloaded that it can cause some backups. There's been some vandalism issues and some other tertiary concerns, but really it's customer service and efficiency, reducing traffic and congestion.
Okay. So you would still have to take a ticket to come in?
No, you wouldn't have to take a ticket to come in. We would have multi-spaced meters, much like we have now on Main Street, where you'd be able to park on one of the parking decks and then just visit the station to pay for your parking that evening.
Okay.
Or that day or for that time period.
All right. I'm going to have to give that more thought. I can't figure out, though. I mean, for somebody coming in just during daytime hours, it's in and out. And how would you know that you're leaving at 7 p.m. because you're going to be enforcing it?
We would be, and we're going to be using license plate technology, so we'll be able to hopefully have some efficiency in staff and labor time there, and we'll typically have the same paradigm that we have today, or the same prism where we give a certain amount of time free for an interim period if you need to run a quick errand, but if you're going to be here for a while, you need to pay that meter, and we'll be enforcing.
Okay, so chalking the tires, is that how it works?
No, it's actually a license plate reader, so we're utilizing technology. The benefit of obviously not having to have someone physically walking around and chalking tires is an efficiency savings for the city.
But it's somebody scanning license plates.
They are, but they're in a vehicle, so that's happening for them.
Okay. Let's see. During a study session, council will be discussing... Did you have anything else, Jonathan, you wanted to add on that? Okay. During a study session, council will be discussing provisions in the Flagstaff Development Agreement for preserving historic mining structures. Every time an item under the Flagstaff Agreement has come up at Planning Commissioner Council, historic preservation advocates, as you know, have argued that the individual developer as well as the Master Owners Association have preservation responsibility. So what will we decide in this study session? Who needs to step up?
Well, we're reporting in, and so staff is reporting in. I think we're really thankful of all the public comment, the work of the historians in our community and planning commissioners, quite frankly, that were interested in compliance issues with the Flagstaff Development Agreement. And as you know, it's a 2001 agreement, so it's almost a 20-year-old agreement now. But I think there's 3 important things. The first was, because of the concerns, we had to try to assess the situation, and we put some experts up on the hillside that visited these sites and took an inventory of the sites and their conditions. The second part was, so the first part is determining, you know, what's happened up there, what has been completed and what hasn't, and then sharing that information with the public, planning commissioners, and city council. And that information has just become available, so we're really looking at that sort of concurrently. The second is, can we come up with funding mechanisms and commitments for resolving any issues moving forward? And we've had several of the property owners kind of voluntarily make commitments up front. And then the third part is, we'll be asking council if they desire to reallocate funding or use funding mechanisms differently to sort of weigh in or lean in and help with the preservation efforts.
Yeah. So why is this a study session and not a work session? Because it looks like public comment that has already been submitted is included. Will there be an opportunity to discuss at the meeting? Because that's usually the difference between the two.
Well, sort of. I mean, work session tends to be a component of our agenda where we'll actually take direction from City Council. Where study session tends to be a much broader, deeper dive on an issue. And again, because we're dealing with a 20-year-old development agreement and there have been all sorts of questions floating around and percolating, staff thought it would be better to really inform, run through the assessment and the review of all of the I don't want to call them landmarks, but all of the properties up there that were in question, run through the public commentary, and then demonstrate to council sort of what the property owners up there that have made kind of voluntary commitments, what those have been to date, and then determine if they have any next steps for staff. So it's going to be a fairly deeper dive. We've got an hour and a half on our agenda, and I will say, although the staff report is over 10 pages, this is one of the better reports I've seen our staff produce. There is a wonderful grid, sort of cheat sheet, if you will, about the Flagstaff Development Historic Preservation sites, their existing conditions, and what might be done moving forward. It's very, very succinct. That being said, I also want to, I want to gauge people's expectations. You know, the commitments are largely signage of sites, revegetation of waste sites and mining dumps, and then there were a few physical structures that required preservation. But I don't want to, give people the impression that every single physical building up there was for somehow was intended to be reconstructed or completely preserved. That wasn't the case. It is largely signage, revegetation, and then there are a few physical buildings that will need some work going forward.
Okay. On the consent agenda, an item is a request to allow the River Horse on Main Street to have an enclosed balcony during the winter. We've seen this before. Is this just a temporary one, or are they just looking for a year-round?
No, it's an annual renewal. There's there's a very specific provision within our within the city's land management code, particularly in the Main Street area, that no balcony or altercation can be over a public right of way, and so it needs to return to a public meeting if that were to happen. And so this is something that we actually began in 2015 as a pilot program. It's the fifth year we've been doing this, and it's an annual approval that you'll see council do unless they were to change the land management code somehow.
All right. The council will receive a debrief on the 2019 Kimball Arts Festival, which happened, of course, the first weekend in August. It was free, the festival, for Summit County primary residents. How do we know? Do we know if that played out well?
Yeah, everybody's very happy. We saw almost 70% increase in locals coming to the event over the three-day weekend than we had in the years past. And so that's something that we're very, very happy about. The economic impact went up over 10% from the year before, and we had over $1 million in sales on the street. So Kimball's a great year-round partner. They continue to work with us on making the event better and better. We had a great gala on Thursday night up at the old Kimball Arts Center, and that was very well done. Didn't impact the neighborhood. We're thrilled.
Okay, so we didn't hear from residents concerned about the noise impacts there.
Nope. Jenny and Candace and Amy Roberts, Kimball, they all worked really, really well together to pull off a great event.
Yeah. Any feedback, though, from the concern that this was limited to just full-time, year-round residents as opposed to our second homeowners?
We had some limited input before the event and some limited input on having to go down to the Kimball building to get your pass. But I think it worked so well that those concerns were largely addressed and assuaged. I think Kimball next year is going to come back and see if they can expand the program. So we've just started having those talks now.
Let's see. Back in June, the council approved a donation of an additional $550,000 to help Utah Open Lands purchase the Armstrong Snow Ranch pastures. That after the $3 million that was passed along with the Treasure Hill Open Space Bond last year. The council will now vote to approve that purchase agreement. That is just finalizing it? Is that what we're doing?
Yeah. So for a lot of us in the community and in City Hall, This is a happy day. This will be a happy day for a lot of us. We've put blood, sweat, and tears into this. This is the culmination of the Treasure Hill and then Snow Ranch Armstrong Pasture Odyssey. And the wonderful news is that we'll have this 19 acres now under conservation agreement in perpetuity, reduces all development potential, and we're incredibly excited to reach this milestone.
Does the city need to continually pay more to maintain that open space?
There will be a little, because there will be some recreational amenities, and some of that funding was included in the bond amount that the voters authorized. But again, this is a really happy day for a lot of us in the community and a lot of us in City Hall that put a lot of work to make sure that these areas weren't developed.
Finally, Community Development Director Ann Lorenz's last day was last week. How's the analysis of her position and whether it needs to be filled going?
Well, that's one of my job and one of City Council jobs, so we're working on that together. Obviously, Ann had a critical role in a lot of different projects around the city, but we're very, very fortunate to have a really strong team around her in the Community Development Department. Ann in sustainability and economic development and in transportation and transportation planning. And so we're stepping back, we're making that evaluation. You know, by and large, we're really moving into an implementation phase, as we've been talking about. A lot of big projects are coming down the pipeline, so we're going to need expertise in a lot of different areas, and we're just trying to say, you know, what are the demands or what are the needs that we need to fulfill, and then who might fulfill those roles, and it might be more than one person. So like anything, when we make these decisions as a public entity, we'll be returning in a public meeting to make those types of decisions and allocations, and we'll be sharing that with you when we get there.
Okay. Anything else?
I mentioned it earlier, but just extra thanks to all the poll workers and everything and everyone, excuse me, who came out and helped the city and the county around the election. It was successful from our standpoint. We had a little traffic on Marsac Ave, and we think we managed that okay. But a lot of work went into our team yesterday, who worked a really full day. So I want to thank everyone for that.
All right, Matt Dias, Jonathan Weidenhammer, thanks. 8:44 now. Good morning. Well, the Rocky Horror Show opens at the Egyptian Theater Friday, November 8th, and then runs through Sunday again next week, Thursday through Sunday. On the phone with me is the director of the production, Eb Mattson. Good morning to you, Eb.
Good morning.
So this is a live theater performance based on the original film?
This is based, so the film actually was based off of this musical. So the musical came first, and then they did the movie version, and then back in 2002, if I remember correctly, they did a revival of it on Broadway.
Okay, well, for those who may have been under a rock, tell us a little bit about the story.
Well, it's about these two kids. Show starts out with them at a wedding, and Brad engages to his high school sweetheart, Janet, and they are going to drive to the home of their friend, Dr. Scott, who taught them in science class and introduced them, and when their car breaks down. And they find a castle where there is a giant party that's going on, and craziness ensues.
Okay, and the castle belonging to Dr. Frankenfurter?
Yes.
Okay. How big is your cast?
It's actually, for us, for the Zig, it's one of our smaller casts. It's a cast of 16.
Okay, and who plays Dr. Frankenfurter?
Jeremy Gross. Jeremy has been seen on the stage up here at the Egyptian a ton. He was Tommy and Tommy. He played Gomez in the Addams Family. He was Jerry in the Full Monty. He's an incredible talent that we have, and he is absolutely electric as Frankenfurter.
Okay. Are you going to be doing a search? Because, I mean, as part of the longstanding tradition of watching the Rocky Horror Show is the Rocky props, the rice, the newspaper, the toast, all banned?
Well, they are not allowing props to come into the show, but we are selling prop bags that do have an assorted amount of the props. We don't have any food products in there just because we want to make sure that we keep the theater nice, but we do have a lot of fun things, and then we also do encourage the shout-outs.
Okay. And, of course, including all of the songs that we know and love?
All of the songs that you know and love, and I believe that there is even one that was cut from the movie that was added that is still in the musical. So,
okay. Anything else you'd like to tell us about it, Eb?
Just that this is such an amazing show. The cast is incredible. One of our narrators is Bill Allred of X96. So if you listen to X96 in the morning, that's our narrator. And it's just an amazing show. The talent in this show is fantastic. The ensemble is amazing. The dancing's incredible. And it's just a stunning visual feat. So.
Okay. It's opening again Friday, November 8th at 8 p.m. We'll run Saturday at 8, Sunday at 6, and then reopening the next Thursday, the 14th, again with shows Thursday, Friday, and Saturday 8 and Sunday at 6. Thursday's prices start at $29. Friday and Saturday's prices start at $35. Eb, thanks for your time this morning.
No, thanks for having me.
KPCW News Time now, 8:48. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Joining me now in the studio, I have Summit County Library Director Dan Compton. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so the library had instituted a fine free program earlier this year. How's that gone?
It's been great. We decided to do this at the same time as the Park City Library, and it's been wonderful for our community, I think. People come into the library. There's less stress now. We don't have to hear people's personal stories about why they were just a day or two late getting those items back. And it's a much more pleasant experience. And we also don't have to block kids from using the library anymore if they had fines. That's all taken care of. And honestly, most of those materials that we were charging fines on, we would have just put back out on the shelf and they would have just been sitting there anyway. So if people can enjoy them a little bit longer, That's great, in my opinion.
Yeah. So what's happening? I mean, are people, because they know they don't have to pay a fee, holding on to the books longer?
Sure. That happens a little bit. People will take advantage of that. But I think for the most part, people are acting the same as they did before. We just don't have, like, people who are returning items on time and that's important to them, they're going to continue to do that. And people who didn't care before are probably going to be late still. And we found that the fines were not really a big motivator for people to bring things back. It's when they know that someone else is waiting for that material that really motivates them to bring it back. So we're seeing that when there are holds, people are like, okay, I'll bring that back right now. And
yeah, and so, how is that notification happening then? I mean, it's if I'm waiting for one of the popular books,
we do a phone call or an email the day the item is due, and then we do four more notices once per week to let you know that material is overdue and you need to return it. And then if someone tries to go renew that item, if it's on hold, it will not allow them to renew it, and they'll know that they need to bring it back.
Okay. So do you think it's saving the staff time by having to do all of those emails?
Those are automatically generated. So it's really not a lot of staff time. We were spending a lot of staff time, however, taking in fines and dealing with that administratively. So I think it's been a good change.
Okay. So no plans to go back?
No.
Yeah.
No way.
Also, the library board was looking into extending hours. And this, I thought this was at the Hennifer branch, but you told me it was at the Colville branch?
Yeah, so at the Hennifer branch, we put in that locker system about a year ago that the community now has access to. They can request items to be delivered out there, and they can access that space 24/7. What we're looking at now is with our Colville branch, they are open the fewest number of hours and have the fewest amount of staff. We'd like to, there's a new a software solution and a vendor that has been working in Europe for the past decade, and now this service is starting to come to the States, where they will basically allow you to give people access to the library building either before or after your normal hours. So if people sign a consent form and go through and agree to all your policies and know that they're going to be on camera and things like that, they could come into the building and pick up their holds, browse the collection, and use the service even with no staff there. So it's kind of a groundbreaking thing. We're applying for an LSTA grant right now. Our pre-application was accepted. We would be the first library in the state to do something like this. So the regular grant cycle ends on December 6th. So we're going to be putting in that application and see what happens. The county council's been supportive of the idea. We had surveyed residents in the county and all over, but you know, we were really looking at Colville to start this pilot program, but the majority of the public wants us to be open for more hours, but we don't really have the ability to hire more staff all the time. And so this would be a solution where we could still give more access without having to necessarily hire more people.
So how does it work? I mean, the doors are basically open 24/7?
Nope, the doors are locked, and your library card is basically the key to the building. So you would come up and scan your card, type in your PIN number, and then the door would unlock. You could come in. We have self-checkout machines that our patrons are now comfortable using. They could pick up their holds, check it out, and go. So if your child has a report due the next day and they didn't tell you and they need to go to the library and get a book, we close at 6 in Colville, and now we could extend. We're looking at least extending those hours till 8 p.m. every night because the Kimball Junction branch is open till 8. And we could kind of have eyes on the library as well, have staff at Kimball Junction available to help people over the phone and things like that. So.
Ah, okay. So, again, you would have access to the entire library, not just the Holt section?
Yes, it would be the whole Colville branch library that you could access. You could use the Wi-Fi, use the public computers. And like on Saturday, they're only open 10 to 2, but Kimball Junction's open 10 to 6, so that would extend it 4 more hours on Saturdays for people to come in and do homework or whatever they need to do.
So is this a pilot program? Is this something we could see extended to all of the branches?
Yes, depending on how it goes, we could possibly try this in Camas and Kimball Junction someday. So we'd like to see how it goes and how it's received.
Okay. I guess what's your biggest concern? I mean, is there, when somebody scans their card, I mean, does some notification go to the sheriff's department or anything that
No, but they're on camera, and they would have to sign an agreement going into this, so they kind of know what they're getting into, that they're going to be on camera, and whatever they do in the facility will be able to see it. So I think that's everyone's biggest concern, though, is the security. But I've talked with library directors from some of the libraries in the states that have done this. There's one in Georgia, one in California, Illinois. They haven't had any problem. They find that the residents view this. It's their library, and they want to take care of it. And those who are using the service really want it to continue. And so they almost kind of police it themselves.
Book readers are good people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then let's see. You said that by December 6th, you'll know whether or not we're going forward with this?
That's just when the application is due. Mm. They won't notify us if we receive it until next year. So we won't know probably till beginning of February if we get it or not.
Okay.
So
are the cameras already installed, or would that need to happen?
Nope. That would be part of the grant.
So what's the earliest this could happen, saying we do get the grant?
It looks like it would happen probably around March or April would be when an installation would take place.
Okay. Finally, you wanted to mention that you've got an author event happening next month?
Yeah, we're really excited. So Neil Schusterman, we have booked for Monday, December 16th at 7 o'clock in Colville at the Ledges Event Center. And Neil is just one of our staff and patron favorites. He's a young adult author. He's won a National Book Award, Prince Honor. His series, Ark of a Scythe, the trilogy has just been completed, so the book came out yesterday, and it's called The Toll. And we've probably promoted that series more in the last couple of years than any other book, and so we're thrilled that he agreed to come here. We've been working with the North Summit School District to make this happen and Dolly's Bookstore. So he will speak for about an hour, and then he'll do a book signing afterwards. It's going to be really fun, and it's free to anyone who would like to attend. You do not need a ticket. You can just show up.
Okay. December 16th, what time?
7 o'clock.
7 p.m.
7 okay. p.m. At the Ledges.
Okay. And then in terms of, I mean, with all of the work done at the Camas Library, what are your numbers like that there? Are you seeing an increased user?
It's been wonderful. So they are getting between 5,000 and 6,000 visits a month, which I think is wonderful considering that's about the population of Camas. So it's like almost everyone in the community, once a month, it's like they're coming to the library. Programming numbers are looking wonderful, and it's just exciting to see that we built this new facility there. It's getting used, and people love it, and I couldn't be happier.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
Didn't know if you want to talk about that, the new Department of Heritage and Arts, but
yeah.
If we have time.
Yep, we got a couple minutes.
So
there, yeah.
The county recently restructured a little bit. So we had the History Department and the Summit County Public Art Advisory Board were functions that were just under administration. After Anita Lewis retired and Navi Vernon, Navi was the county historian. The county manager met with me and we talked about it and really felt that those functions would fit well with the library. And so we've created this new Department of Heritage and Arts, kind of modeled after what the state does on a much smaller scale. But we thought it would be great for these departments to all be under the same umbrella. We can help support and promote each other. Libraries are like cultural centers. We were doing art displays. We were having historical lectures anyway. And so it kind of made sense for us to have these functions together. And then we can really work on programming together more than we ever have in the past. So I'm excited about this new change.
Yeah. So so far, good response then from the council. I mean, it's a budget item. They have to approve it.
Yeah. And it really didn't have a big budget impact because we're just repurposing current staff. We just kind of changed the structure. So,
okay.
But they seem to be happy with the direction we're headed so far.
So that you then become the director of the department?
So I'll be the director of the Department of Heritage and Arts, but I will still be the library director as well.
Okay. All right. Dan, hey, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.